Welcome to the Books of Titans podcast, where I seek truth in the world's great books. I'm your host, Eric Rostad, coming to you from the beautiful Books of Titans studio in Franklin, Tennessee. My goal is to read 200 of the great books over the next 10 years and share what I'm learning. I'll talk a bit about each book, tie ideas together from a variety of genres, and share the one thing I always hope to remember from each of the great books. Today I'm going to cover The Iliad by Homer. This is book 5 for my 2024 reading list, and it's book 6 on my great books list. Well, C.S. Lewis once said, "I can't imagine a man really enjoying a book and reading it only once." Well, for most of my reading project, Books of Titans, I have read each book just once. But for The Iliad and The Odyssey, I wanted to read them both twice. I knew that they were important books. I knew that I would see references to them in a number of the other books that I was reading. And I really wanted to make sure that I got the story down. So in this episode, I'm covering my second reading of The Iliad. I'll link in the show notes to the episode I did last year after reading it for the first time, as in reading it for the first time ever in my entire life. So this episode, I'll focus more on the things that really stuck out to me in reading it a second time. My main focus on that first reading last year was to get the story down, to understand the overall arc of the story, the narrative, and to really just get the basics down in that aspect. The second reading, I wanted to dig in deeper. So to that end, I paired this reading with a companion guide, and I'll talk a little bit more about each of those, the translation I did, the companion guide, and all that. But this one, I tried to focus more on the details, having more of the story already in my head at this point. So I need to start this episode by saying that I have a new favorite book now, and it is The Iliad. I was just amazed. I mean, I loved it when I read it last year, and I liked it more than The Odyssey, but this second reading, it blew me away. I was able to focus on things that I didn't even notice on the first reading, and there were also periods when I read this book during March of this year where, due to schedule, I only had time for like a few pages. But even those few pages, reading those few pages in one sitting, I was just amazed at how much was there and how much it connected to the rest of the book, how much detail, just how rich even sitting down to two pages was. And so I want to cover some of those things in this episode, talk about some of those things. But before I do that, let me just say, if you have not read The Iliad, please make it a point to do so. It is so good. It is so rich. And I hope, if nothing else, that this episode really encourages you to read The Iliad if you have not read it. So in the companion guide that I read, it said that the two most referenced books in history are, can you guess? What do you think they would be? Well, they are the Bible and the Iliad. And those are the two books that I started off reading this year. So I read the Bible in January and February of this year, just straight through from Genesis to Revelation. And then right after that, on March 1st, I started reading the Iliad here. So it's kind of fun that the two most referenced in history are the two that I started off 2024. So for this second reading, I read the Robert Fitzgerald translation. And I had that one suggested to me, and I liked it very much. I found it to be easy to read. The translation didn't get in the way at all. I'm not an expert in translations, and I don't know Greek, so just at a very basic level, like I enjoyed it. I also found one particular choice that Fitzgerald made in his translation to be very, well, it was just delightful. So I first noticed this when I read The Odyssey last year for the second time, and I read Fitzgerald's translation for The Odyssey. And I noticed something, that every time the god Hermes would speak, that Fitzgerald would translate that into rhyme. So every two lines, the last word would rhyme. And that was not the case with any of the other gods, with any of the other text in the book, and he would just do that for Hermes. So I was guessing that he would do it in the Iliad that way as well, and he did. Hermes only has like a few lines, a few pages of actual speech in the Iliad, but lo and behold, Fitzgerald did it again. He rhymed anything that Hermes said in Only Him. I just love that. I think that is the coolest thing, the neatest translation choice. And so that was one thing that really stuck out about the Fitzgerald translation. The companion guide that I read is called A Companion to the Iliad, and it's by Malcolm W. Wilcock. So real quick, here's reading stats. I read this between March 1st and 25, so that was the Iliad along with the companion guide. The Iliad itself was 626 pages, and that included the introduction. That took me 19 hours and 55 minutes to read. That's contrasted to the Iliad reading it the first time last year. That took me 23 hours. So this one took me over 3 hours, or this one took me 3 hours less. I think, again, just I was really focusing that first reading on getting the story down and taking my time with that. So this reading, it took me 25 days to get through the Iliad. I have two more segments in this episode. Segment two, I will share three ideas that stuck out to me. And I just want to kind of focus on things that I noticed in this second reading at a level that I didn't notice in the first reading, or it just stuck out to a different level on this time. And then segment three, I'll close out like I do my other episodes with my one key takeaway from this reading of the Iliad. Okay, let's dig into the Iliad here. I'm gonna divide this segment into three different parts. The first part is just some things that stuck out in my second reading of the book. And the first is this, and it deals with Patrocles. And Homer would write about Patrocles, and this was Achilles' great friend, and Hector kills Patrocles, and then that sets off the whole range of action in the end of the story. But Homer would be writing about Patrocles in the third person, and almost the entire story is in the third person about what's happening and that sort of thing. And then all of a sudden, Homer would shift to the second person in writing about Patrocles. And this is something that I blew right past in my first reading of the book. And it was something that was pointed out in the companion guide that I read. But it's just this endearing picture of Homer, that he loves this character so much that he starts referring to him as you. So like, you know, Patrocles then went and did this and then did this. And you, Patrocles, you started doing this. It's like this, it's like Homer shifts as he's talking about Patrocles and starts like his love of the character just overcomes him to where he shifts voice. And again, just something I didn't even notice the first time, but such a delightful thing to be aware of or to notice. And I just love that idea of this story 2,500 plus years old and the author of it just being so enamored with one of the characters that he shifts to the second person. That was so cool. Another thing is, and this is kind of an embarrassing thing to mention, but when I came across Diomedes in the second reading, I had completely forgotten about him. And this is somebody that takes up a large part of, especially the first half of the book. And he's kind of a replacement character for Achilles, who is holed up in his ship and not wanting to fight. So Diomedes is this Greek that's kind of the big fighter, and he's in a lot of the main scenes in the absence of Achilles being there. And in the second reading, I didn't even remember him. And so embarrassing, but just kind of funny how I can forget an entire character and then in the second reading, like, oh yeah, that person was here this whole time. So another thing that I found out and learned, especially in the, well, I learned it in the companion guide. I wouldn't have picked up on this on my own, but Homer makes up a number of the myths that are in the Iliad in order to suit his narrative. And we know this because we have a lot of these myths in other locations, and so the details are different. Or Homer would just make up stuff wholesale, but it would for the purpose of fitting into the Iliad or moving the narrative along or something like that. And again, it's just kind of one of those endearing or delightful things. And I don't know, I guess in my head, I just have this picture of this is the perfect story. It's lasted all this time. And that if Homer's referencing a myth, you know, it is perfectly stated and, you know, this is what the myth actually was. But it's not the case. And he would just kind of have fillers in there. So I thought that was fun. Let me get into the second main thing of segment two here, just of, something that stuck out in this second reading, and it goes back to the will of Zeus. So if you listen to my first episode, that was a key theme that I followed throughout. If you read the very first section, the very first paragraph of this entire epic, in fact, let me stop and do that real quickly. I that's how I started off the first episode of the Iliad. Anger be now your song, immortal one. Achilles' anger doomed Enruneus, that caused the Achaeans loss on bitter loss, and crowded brave souls into the undergloom, leaving so many dead, carrion for dogs and birds, and the will of Zeus was done. Begin it when the two men first contending broke with one another, the Lord Marshal Agamemnon, Atreus' son, and Prince Achilles. And I'll stop reading there. Again, that is the Robert Fitzgerald translation, but the two things you notice there are anger, so Achilles' anger, and then the will of Zeus. And so in my first reading, those were two things that I followed throughout. So what role did Achilles' anger play in the Iliad, and then what role did the will of Zeus? And so you can listen to that first episode and how I spoke about those things. But in the second reading, I think what I pictured as the will of Zeus was something that was in Zeus's head, and it was going to be Zeus's will, like what he deemed to be right. And then it was out of his mind, and he, you know, there was no influence anywhere. It's just, this is the will of Zeus. This is the will of the supreme being. And then what we're going to see in the Iliad is what he wants to have happen. And I think in the second reading here, what I saw is that it's not that way. And I knew that to some degree, but I guess not to the degree that he was influenced. And he was influenced by Thetis, who is Achilles' mother, but Thetis was influenced by Achilles' wrath and Achilles' anger. So again, in that first paragraph, we have Achilles' anger, and then we have the will of Zeus. But you see how that anger of Achilles, it wasn't just on this human level of Achilles not wanting to fight and being angry at Agamemnon, and so not fighting in the battle, and a lot of Greeks dying because of that and all that. That's part of it. But then the part that connects to Zeus is Achilles asks Thetis, his mother, to talk to Zeus about this. And so what Zeus decides is that the way he's going to get Achilles to join the battle is to let the Trojans get super close to the Greek ships and even start one of them on fire. And then that will get Achilles back into the battle. But this is because Thetis has petitioned Zeus on behalf of Achilles. And so I want to read just a few parts and how this, I guess, kind of shifted my thinking a little bit in this. So here's the first part. This is on page 325. This must be somehow satisfactory to the high mind of Zeus, that far from Argos, Achaeans perish here without a name. I knew it when he favored us and saved us. I know it now when he glorifies our enemies, treating them like gods. He tied our hands. He took the heart out of us. End quote. This is Agamemnon speaking, and he's speaking about the high mind of Zeus and how it is shifted. So Zeus has shifted, and he's now treating the enemies, he's treating the Trojans like gods, and then he has tied the Greeks' hands, he's took the heart out of them. And so Agamemnon notices that something's going on here as part of the will of Zeus. Let's jump to page 345 and 346. So here I'm going to read a kind of a larger section in this one. And with this one, this is Zeus speaking here. Let him shatter the Achaeans into a retreat, helpless in panic till they reach the ships of Peleus' son, Achilles. Then that prince will send Patroclus, his great friend, to war, and Hector in glory before Ilion, by a spear cast will bring Patroclus down, though he destroy a host of men, my son Sarpedon being among them. Aye, for this the prince Achilles in high rage will kill heroic Hector. From that moment, I'll turn the tide of battle on the beach decisively once for all, until the Achaeans capture Ilion, as Athena planned and willed it. But until that killing, I shall not remit my wrath, nor shall I let another god take part on the Danian side. No, not before the heart's desire of the son of Peleus shall have been consummated. So I promised, so with a nod I swore, that day when Thetis touched my knees and begged me to give honor to Achilles, raider of cities. End quote. So again, this is Zeus speaking, and this is pretty incredible, because this is in book 15, and he's basically telling what's going to happen in the rest of the Iliad. And he says he will turn the tide of battle on the beach once once Hector reaches the ships. And then I find it interesting too that he says, but until that killing, I will not remit my wrath. And here it's not Achilles' wrath, but it's Zeus's wrath. So he's talking about his wrath. And then at the very end, so I promised, so with a nod I swore, that day when Thetis touched my knees and begged me to give honor to Achilles, raider of cities. So he's mentioning here that this is because of the petition by Thetis. So now let me go to page 4. Oh, sorry. Before that, 362. And here we have another part here. Let me read this. That day, the purpose of his heart was to confer the glory on Hector, Priam's son, enabling him to cast bright, tireless fire on the ships and so fulfill the special prayer of Thetis. Zeus, the Lord of Wisdom, awaited that to see before his eyes the lightning glare of a ship ablaze, for from that moment on he had in mind reversal for the Trojans and glory for the Danians. Lord Zeus himself defended him and gave him honor and power alone amid the host, for he would be diminished soon. A day of wrath for him at Lord Achilles' hands was being wrought even then by Pallas Athena. End quote. So that last part's talking about Hector. So Zeus protects Hector for the purpose of letting him get to the ships and bring fire to the ships so that to fulfill the special prayer of Thetis. But then from that point, it would be a day of wrath for him at Lord Achilles' hands. So you've got Zeus here empowering Hector in order to hasten the day of revenge brought about by Achilles' entry into the war. And then that will bring about Hector's eventual death. And let's continue on to page 431, where Thetis says to Achilles, "Zeus did all you asked." End quote. So again, you've got this picture of the wrath of Achilles, the anger of Achilles, kind of directing the action in a way that influences the will of Zeus. And it's a slight distinction, I guess my thinking that the will of Zeus was this set thing the Iliad moves forward as exactly planned by Zeus. And in the first episode, I acknowledged that that's complicated because the gods are fighting one another. You know, Zeus is being pulled this way and that. But it was interesting just to see that how closely tied together those two things are, of the anger of Achilles and the will of Zeus, and how through Thetis, the mother who petitioned Zeus, how all these things come together. I just found that to be fascinating and at a much deeper level than in my first reading of the book. So here's the third item in segment two here that I want to focus on. And this I came across in the companion guide, and I thought was just amazing. It was one of those things that just, this is such an incredible work. This is such an incredible story. But to see how incredible it really is, how things tie together. In the companion guide, the Malcolm Wilcock ties together books 1 and 24. So book 1 is the very first book, obviously, in the Iliad. Book 24 is the final book. And there are 5 themes, and the 5 themes are flipped in a lot of ways. So I just want to read through these. In book 1, you have the rejection of the father, who is Croesus, who wishes to ransom his daughter. And so this kind of kicks things off. Agamemnon refuses to give back this daughter to this father, this priest father who's begging, just this heartrending scene, but this father's begging for his daughter back. And Agamemnon says no. You contrast that with book 24, where Achilles agrees with Priam that he may ransom the body of his son. So you have a rejection of a plea of a father in book one. You have a reception, an agreement with the father for the ransom in book 24. In book one, you have a quarrel between Achilles and Agamemnon. In book 24, you have a friendly conversation between Achilles and Priam, between Achilles and his enemy, the king of the Trojans. You have a friendly conversation, but in book one, you've got a quarrel between men who are on the same side. In book one, you have Thetis speaking to Achilles and agreeing to take a message to Zeus. And then in book 24, you have Thetis speaking to Achilles, having brought a message from Zeus. So just kind of a reversal in that sense. But again, Thetis is kind of this go-between between Achilles and Zeus. In book one, there is Thetis meeting with Zeus. And then again, in book 24, there's Zeus kind of sending Thetis on to Achilles. Book one, you have a dispute among the gods. And again, in book 24, there is a dispute among the gods. So again, just these themes showing up in book one, in many ways, their fulfillment being brought about in book 24. And again, this is something I would not have noticed on my own. I just think it's an incredible connection point. But there's so many like that. There are a number of battles in the Iliad that give a foretaste of another battle. And again, that's something that you really notice on a second reading. You're able to pick up on the foretelling, the connection points in a way that you just can't on the first reading, because you're so engaged with the story. You're trying to get your foot in on the story and just understanding it. So, you know, read it more than once. You're going to notice some just amazing things in the story. I want to just mention one thing that I did not particularly like about Robert Fitzgerald's translation, and that's his use of the word anger. Again, I'm no Greek scholar, but just in reading the story and thinking about the story and how much of a part Achilles' anger is, I think Emily Wilson did a better job with that, where she translated it as cataclysmic wrath. And there are so many aspects of that can be called cataclysmic. That to me was a better translation and more fitting with the story. Anger to me is like you're angry. It might get to the point where you punch the wall, but cataclysmic wrath is more in line with what happens in this story. Punching the wall is not in line with what happens in this story. It is much deeper, many deaths, much pain and suffering and sorrow because of this wrath. And so wrath or cataclysmic wrath, I think, gets a lot closer to it than anger. So that's my two cents on the Robert Fitzgerald translation, which otherwise I just thoroughly loved and enjoyed. So that's kind of some things that stuck out here in the second reading of the Iliad. Now in segment three, I will get on to the one thing. So a number of things happened between my first and second reading of the Iliad, and even though it was just 6 or 7 month difference in when I first read it to the second reading here, I really got involved in the story. I got involved with Homer. I read the Odyssey twice in between that time. I read all of Homer's hymns, or the hymns that are attributed to Homer, and those are about the gods. I read a book by Caroline Alexander about that was called Achilles, or The War That Killed Achilles, and just kind of went deeper into that. I also read this other book called Ransom, and it's a retelling of the story of Priam visiting Achilles at the end of the Iliad in book 24. And it's just kind of this reimagining of what would that have been like. And it got you deep into the pain, the courage of that story. And so that's something I've been thinking about a lot. And so one thing that stuck out, and this is my one thing for the second reading of the Iliad here, is the scene before all that happens, and it's the scene where Achilles is fighting Hector. And Achilles has just given the death blow. He's stabbed Hector in the neck. So it says he drove his point straight through the tender neck, but did not cut the windpipe, leaving Hector able to speak and to respond. And so here we get into some dialogue between Hector and Achilles. And Priam is Hector's father. After this death, Achilles will strap Hector by his heels, ironically, and drag him. And then we'll just continue nearly every day just dragging Hector around and for the purpose of destroying his body. And that's against all scenes of decency and all that. And it's just destroying Priam, his father, to know that his son is being dragged around like this. But this dialogue right after Achilles has killed Hector in a sense, but Hector still has a few breaths left in him. I just want to read this and then tie it to that ending with Priam and Achilles. So here's Hector, and Robert Fitzgerald says, barely whispering, he replies, I beg you by your soul and by your parents, do not let the dogs feed on me in your encampment by the ships. Accept the bronze and gold my father will provide as gifts. My father and her ladyship, my mother, let them have my body back so that our men and women may accord me decency of fire when I am dead. And that is the end of that part that Hector is speaking. So I beg you by your soul and by your parents, don't let the dogs feed on me. This is a big deal for someone to be cremated on the pyre, for the body to be burned. This is a big deal. If the body is not burned, then it's just, you don't want that. And so here's Achilles' response to what Hector has just asked. Beg me no beggary by soul or parents, whining dog. First off, it's just amazing that response, because remember, Hector begs him, I beg you by your soul and by your parents, do not let the dogs feed on me. And Achilles responds by beg me no beggary by soul or parents. So he addresses that right away, not by your soul or by your parents. Whining dog. And so ties the dogs in two there. Would God my passion drove me to slaughter you and eat you raw. You've caused such agony to me. No man exists who could defend you from the carrion pack. Not if they spread for me 10 times your ransom, 20 times, and a promise more as well. Not if Priam, son of Dardanus, tells them to buy you for your weight in gold. You'll have no bed of death, nor will you be laid out and mourned by her who gave you birth. Dogs and birds will have you every scrap. End quote. And then here is Hector's response. I see you now for what you are. No chance to win you over. Iron in your breast, your heart is. Think a bit, though. This may be a thing the gods in anger hold against you on that day when Paris and Apollo destroy you at the gates, great as you are. Even as he spoke, the end came, and death hid him, spirit from body fluttered to under gloom. Later on, Achilles says this, die, make an end. I shall accept my own whenever Zeus and the other gods desire. End quote. So a couple things to point out here. Achilles is not swayed by the promise of a ransom, by the promise of 10 times or 20 times the amount. Not if Priam himself tells them to buy your weight in gold. And I think that is key, tells them. And even the word ransom is mentioned there. And then Hector's response with no chance to win you over. I see you now for what you are. So I want to pick out two of those pieces there. Later, so that this is all in book 22. Later in book 24, when Priam goes on his own, he's got one person with him taking him along, and then Hermes the god guides them on the way into the camp of the Greeks. So out of the walls of Troy, Priam goes to go to Achilles personally and beg for the body of his son. And it works. And what's interesting in the things that I just read of the part where Achilles is responding to Hector and promises more as well. Not if Priam tells them to buy you for your weight in gold. So when he's speaking to Hector, he says, not even if Priam tells them to bring gold, but here comes Priam himself with a cart laden with gifts. But Priam comes in person. And I think that's such a key thing, because you see earlier in the story where Agamemnon is trying to get back in the good graces of Achilles so that Achilles will start fighting again for the Greeks. He's withheld fighting because he's angry at Agamemnon. And that, again, in that first paragraph of the entire Iliad, that is what sets off the story, the battle between these two men. And Achilles promises, Agamemnon promises Achilles all these things. And you're just kind of thinking, Achilles, you're crazy not to take all this. It's just thing after thing that he's promised. But Agamemnon does not go himself to Achilles to give him these things. He sends three people and it doesn't work. Achilles does not, he agrees to stay, but he does not fight at that time. And so you see in Achilles, this thing that Hector points out here, I see now for what you are, no chance to win you over. And yet Achilles is won over, and he's won over by Priam. And Priam is the ransom. Priam brings these gifts as a ransom, but it wouldn't have worked had not Priam himself gone. And there's just this, it's just an amazing thing. And for Hector to say, I see you now for what you are, no chance to win you over. Zeus, in sending Priam to Achilles, knew Achilles for what he was. It's something Hector didn't see. And it's something that Zeus saw. And so kind of tying again back to this will of Zeus, it's an incredible picture at the end of the story that, one, the ransom was not the gifts, because the gift itself was not what Achilles wanted. Achilles wanted the person himself to do it. And so when Agamemnon doesn't do it, you see the response of Achilles. When Priam goes and surprises Achilles with going by himself, the king going to the man who just killed his son, it works. Priam was the ransom. Zeus understood Achilles at a deeper level than perhaps even Achilles didn't know, that he could be won over in this person-to-person where Priam was the ransom. That's such a deep thing, and it's such an amazing thing to consider. And I love that. I love that, you know, that speech when Hector is dying, I wouldn't have picked up on that on the first reading. I almost had to know the rest of the story for those words to stick out, for it to mean something deeper. And so I understood it more the second reading. So that's my one thing this time. And again, it's just something I wouldn't have noticed that first reading. But Priam is the ransom. It's not just the gifts, but it's the fact that Priam went himself. They wept together. Priam kisses the hand of the man who killed his son. Just an incredible ending. And one of those things that just makes this a work above all others in my mind. So to recap, I learned some important things about rereading books in the second reading of the Iliad. I'll probably do this either for really short, great books or for the really great, great books. I did it with the Iliad in the Odyssey. I'll probably do it with the Aeneid and then just a few others on the way. I did it with the Epic of Gilgamesh too, just to make sure I really got the story down. So with some of these great books, I do want to make a point, and especially after this second reading of the Iliad, I just see how important that is. I do want to get through a large list of books, but there is great value in taking the time to get these books and have them dwell deep within me. I've also learned to some degree to love the nuances of different translations. And I say this as a complete amateur, and I probably only noticed 5% of differences, but it's an intriguing area. And I would like to revisit the Iliad for the rest of my life. And I would like to read a different translation each time. I've already started collecting them, and I can't wait to see what each one brings to the table. So up next for the podcast, the next episode, I'm going to have a little fun, and I'm going to compare the Iliad to the movie Troy. I've watched Troy a couple times now, and it's just kind of fun to see the differences. There's some huge differences. There's some things they did very well, I thought, in the movie. And so I just want to talk about those, the things they got so badly wrong, and then the things that I thought they did a great job on. After that, I'm going to cover the Greek epic fragments of the Iliad, the Sack of Ilion, and the Cypria. Now, these are stories that kind of give further context of the Iliad, kind of like what happens after the Iliad. And as I mentioned in episode one, the first episode that I covered the Iliad after the first reading, I was just surprised that there was not the kidnapping of Helen. I was surprised that we didn't learn about the Trojan horse and all that. And from what I understand in these Greek epic fragments, you get the rest of the story. So I can't wait to read those. So I'll cover that in an episode a couple from now. And then, as I mentioned, later on in life, I just want to continue reading different translations of the Iliad. So here are the ones that I would like to read at some point. The Alexander Pope translation, which is in rhyme. So each two lines, the end of the final word rhymes. I think that would just be fun to do. I've been told in the last week, two people have mentioned the Lombardo translation and saying it is just like super raw on the battle scenes. And so I want to get that one and read that one. The Lattimore one is kind of the standard. And in fact, the companion guide that I read, it was based on the translation by Richmond Lattimore. So I want to read that one. I have the Robert Fagles translation, have not read it yet. Part of the Catherine project that I was involved with, where I was reading it the first time last year, they read the Fagles translation. I was reading the Emily Wilson translation. So I heard a number of parts in the Fagles translation, but have not read it yet. I'd love to read the Caroline Alexander one. And then the Peter Green one seems to be a favorite as well. But I do want to pose the question of, what is your favorite translation of the Iliad? And I'd love your response. You can respond to me by email or on social media. And my email is eric@booksoftitans.com. That's going to do it for this episode. Thank you for listening. I'd love to hear from you. If you are an Iliad enthusiast, please email me. Let me know the things that stick out to you when you read the Iliad. Let me know your favorite translation. Let me know perhaps some other books that I should read with the Iliad, maybe other companion guides or novels like Ransom, that book I read, and that I will link to in the show notes. Something that just kind of gives further insight into the Iliad. I would love to hear about that. You can follow Books of Titans on Instagram or Twitter, and I have a website, booksoftitans.com. Just got a ton of resources there. First, I just share all my reading lists, and you can click on any book and see what I thought about the book. With the Great Books Project, I have my Great Books list. I have, for each of the Great Books, some of the other books that I'm reading along with the Great Book. And so take a look there. Like I said, next week I'll be back with the episode comparing the Iliad to the movie Troy. And then after that, the Greek epic fragments, where I kind of share a little bit about some of the stories surrounding the Iliad. Until then, keep reading, keep learning, and keep listening. I'm out.